we say it. So that's more what life is like, or like, you know, walking on the street, which we've become accustomed to having be a little bit slow and then having someone speed, or trying to understand how to live with many people in an apartment that formerly had a few people in it, or whatever it is that we're doing now. So I want to say that there's a kind of a supposition of harmony, because we think of the value of Sangha, the beauty of Sangha, as harmony, as peace and harmony. That's its primary, ultimate virtue. And so we tend to kind of assume it and paper over the differences sometimes. So there can be a silence culture in Sangha that not many people point out or talk about. And I don't know whether it's true for a Sangha that's non-residential, because a Sangha that's non-residential, in which everybody maintains your own life, you have touch points to be who you are. And to, but I think that silence is an issue that everybody has to deal with. Silence in situations of difference or disharmony is something that everybody has to deal with. And that's hard to do for everyone. For instance, if you need to give feedback to somebody, or if you assumed, like I had a situation today that came up today where someone hadn't told me the pay arrangement before I taught a yoga class. And then there were only going to be two people in the class, but I taught it anyway because the people who were administering the venue asked me to do that because they had already canceled it twice. So I taught, and then they said, oh, well, the co-teacher is going to be paid for seven people because that's their regular class, but you were just co-teaching, so you'll be paid for two people. And basically my attitude was, the hell you say. No, you know, I equally shared this teaching. It wasn't like I taught two people and you taught seven people. I taught nine people and you taught nine people. What's going on? What's up with that? You know, so when we're faced with a situation in which we have to give feedback, how does practice enter into it? When we're faced with a situation that's different from what we think it should be, or different from what we that actually turns out different from what we perceive it to be. So where somebody needs to give us feedback or tell us about something, or a situation that's dissonant for us, it can give rise first to a feeling of discomfort and doubt. And I want to say that discomfort and doubt, particularly in the practice, is really up there in the traditional fetters that bind us to the reification of self. So what that little puff of adrenaline, maybe I'm the only person who has ever felt it, but the little puff of adrenaline when someone gets the last serving of potatoes, you know, or when, you know, our kid is well behaved and their kid is not. That little puff of adrenaline, or when someone cuts in front of us, or whatever. The real place where we have to put our money where our mouth is in terms of practice is those places. And so these fetters, bonds, that these chains that bind us to fixed ways of doing things really get in the way of expressing freedom. So we can have as many wonderful experiences of unity and harmony and simplicity as we wish, but there's actually a practice associated with bringing that feeling into the rough and tumble of everyday life, negotiations, you know, standing in lines, meeting deadlines, having to retire, you know, all sorts of situations, physiological changes, and so on. So, you know, the very first fetter is Satkaya Drishti, or taking form as real, taking form as ultimately real. And the second one is this doubt that comes from that taking self and other as ultimately real. So so we get discomfort with that, a sense of dissonance when we think that the self is ultimately real, and then when something threatens it and we're afraid or we want to fight or we're you know, we attach, or any one of a number of other emotional reactions that are basically on autopilot for us. The thing that underlies that is a feeling of dissonance or difference, which is a psychological discomfort. It's a form of pain or discomfort that comes when two thoughts or perceptions don't seem to jive. Suzuki Roshi talked about this in the beginning of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, where he says, everything is always falling out of balance against a background of perfect harmony. So he talks about the background of perfect harmony as a background, and the foreground of what we experience as kind of out of balance or out of sync. And that little sense of out of sync we call dukkha or suffering. And it really has an interesting etymology, that word for suffering in Sanskrit, dukkha, because if the etymology is like in a wheel in which the spokes are slightly different lengths, when you actually try to use that wheel, it goes ka-chunk, 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 instead of whir. That's dukkha, that discomfort of ka-chunk, ka-chunk, things getting stuck and bound. So, you know, particularly when there's an inconsistency between what we believe and what seems to happen, or between what we believe and how we behave, that's called dissonance. And it's founded on difference. And Zen teaching aims to harmonize unity and difference. But how? You know, in Zazen, you know, we can feel the texture of the differences, and they come into harmony because every inhalation is a birth process and a death process. So we're faced with the ultimate fact of our mortality and something that's not mortality with every breath. So in Zazen, we can experience harmony if we sit with perfect attention to posture and breathing and great pure effort, we can experience that. But in everyday life, we forget the unease of bearing the inconsistency between what we think should happen and what we actually perceive to happen, or between how we think we should be and how we actually act. That can motivate us to various reactions, and that motivation can be used for good or for ill. So we want to use it for good, and using it for good is called practice. So I just want to point out, this is probably really obvious, but when there's huge dissonance, there's big motivation. And when there's small dissonance, there's a small motivation. And that in Zazen, because nothing else is happening, the dissonance becomes larger and larger in our mind. So there's traditional teachings about it, but first I want to give an example of dissonance. So when I entered Tassajara in 1980, there's this practice called Tangaryo, in which you sit for 5 days. You sit with your deep intention, and you manifest that intention in your Zazen practice. And as I was sitting there, I started to sweat and feel afraid. You know, so I'm sitting there, and then all of a sudden, right in front of me, in letters of fire on the plain white wall, started being written O P P R E S S I O N. Oppression. O P P. Letters of fire going right across my line of sight. And I kept going, go away, go away, go away, go away. This is not what I'm here for. I'm here to sit. I'm here to enter the monastery. I'm not here. Go away, stupid word. You're not true. Go away. And it kept kind of patiently writing itself. O, P, P, letters of fire, right? It became worse and worse, and I sweat more and more as I saw it. Anyway, I finished Tongariro, and then I wasn't very quick on the uptake. You know, like 3 months later, at the end of the practice period, I thought, I wonder whether this has anything to do with me. You know, but I was feeling that discomfort the whole time. And it took 3 months before I said to myself, I wonder whether that has anything to do with me. It's like 3 months of this word writing itself in front of me. So that probably seems really stupid to you. Like, who wouldn't think that had something to do with them if it was writing themselves, you know, like in foot-high letters in front of the person in letters of fire? You'd think, oh, gee, this is something I should pay attention to. But for me, it was more like, I'm not, this has nothing to do with me. This is just a word. Go away, stupid word. So that's an example of dissonance, where something is coming up that's real, and your beliefs say it's not real. Of course it's real, you know. So anyway, I grew up in a family that has like a Holocaust survivor family, and I'm a first generation American. So of course it's real, but I didn't know it for months. Anyway, this doubt where, you know, you're kind of sitting there with the holding both things at the same time, both the letters of fire and the go away stupid word at the same time is intensely uncomfortable. It's intensely uncomfortable. And so if a wholesome motivation would say, I wonder if I should look into this. Maybe this has something to do with me. But an unwholesome motivation is go away stupid word. You have nothing to do with me, and I'm going to deny you. But the, you know, Tongariro and actually sitting and facing it every day doesn't allow you to deny. Anyway, I want to just go into the teachings of the Abhidharmakosha Bhashyam for a moment, and that was written by Vasubandhu, and it was kind of an encyclopedia that is a summary of 1,000 years of debate about what we call the dharmas, which are atoms of experience that break down when we think of the world and ourselves in terms of either categories of experience or atoms of experience, then the grip of the reified self begins to loosen, and we begin to enjoy the possibility of freedom. So in the Abhidharmakosha Bhashyam, Vasubandhu summarizes the teachings on this dharma of doubt, the doubt or dissonance, as being in two minds about truth. And how it functions is that it becomes a basis of ignorance for not becoming involved with positive forms of practice or of life. And so how you abandon it, how you outgrow it, is through insight. And how you continue to be pushed around and bullied by it is when you nourish it through wrong view. Because that kind of doubt or dissonance dies when the ignorance at its base is at its root is not nourished, it can't bear its little ugly flowers if you don't nourish the root, which is ignorance. And what's so interesting about this kind of doubt or this discomfort that comes from holding two two possibilities for truth, but being dominated by autopilot or habits at the same time, is that affects the entire field of perception and action. And Vasubandhu talked about this more than 1,000 years ago. And that was the product of 1,000 years of debate. At Nalanda University, which was the North in India, great center, which before, you know, the 20th century was the greatest confluence of different sorts of meditation disciplines that the world had seen to that point, that was like collected and written. So doubt can be shallow in that it could be something that just affects our reactions. So that's like, that can be cured by the ways that we cure habits. But it can also be really deep, affecting our physiological responses and sometimes even how we're constructed at the deepest possible level. And it can also come to the surface as a manifestation, or it can be latent, like a little seed that stays in us. And what it means is that what it does is that it gets in the way of recognizing whether an action or a word is leading to suffering or whether it's leading to non-suffering. Basically, it's just confusing because we're ignorant and don't know. So how did Vasubandhu say that we grow out of this kind of doubt that has ignorance as its basis and dissonance as its function in our view? So there's several ways. I mean, one of the ways is by understanding the direction of practice. So understanding what the path is. So right view, right intention, you know, right action, right livelihood, right speech, etc. So by understanding the path. So that's one way we can grow out of them, because when we experience that dissonance, we can say, oh, but my practice is to do right speech. So this dissonance that's motivating me to say something really confused and wrong is something I should actually sit with until I can say something right. So that's one way we grow out of it, is by recognizing that there is a path that we can practice. And another way is by having insights into the truth, into ultimate truth, relative truth, or skillful means that free us from desire and aversion, you know? So having an aversive feeling doesn't mean that something is bad. Having a pleasant feeling doesn't mean that something is good. So when we're free from those feelings and are actually have a sense of practicing the precepts and zazen, we're protected, we're armored against the kind of wounding that dissonance can give to us. So the first two are understanding a direction. The second one is understanding the truth. And then the third one is to free ourselves from even the truth, you know, so to allow ourselves to be free from even looking like a good meditator. And so what's in Zen practice, sometimes what's said is after enlightenment, you go live under a bridge for 30 years. Anyway, you know, so that's what allows us to free ourselves from it. And what allows us to not free ourselves from it is the more we need stability, consistency, and control in our life, the more that any little thing that comes along is to put us outside of our window of tolerance, the more we'll feel the impact of dissonance and be pushed around by it. So we tend to resolve it, and this is so interesting, and this is where that word began to come into play. As I sat there longer and longer for 3 months, I realized that the unwholesome ways I resolved this dissonance of seeing this word oppression, the first one was by oppressing myself. You know, oppression meaning that the thing had already risen, but I wouldn't allow it to be arisen. So the first thing I did was to oppress myself. That's unwholesome. That's a violence against myself. And the second thing was by suppression. So silence. You know, by not saying to myself, oh, this is arising for me, when it actually was arising for me, I silenced myself. So because I had a cultural bias that silence was goodness. After all, I was in a monastery where I should be silent, right? So silence is goodness. So being silent meant there was nothing wrong, which led to the third thing, which was repression. So oppression, suppression, and repression, three types of pressure or violence that I put on myself to not have to feel dissonance. That's called denial. Okay, so anyway, I just wanted to tell you this sad little story of, 40 years ago, because it's separated in time and I don't have to be super embarrassed by it right now, but there's plenty of examples from now. Examples even from today. But I do want to talk about how to resolve it and some particular ways in body, speech, and mind. So the first thing that I would say, when we're faced with dissonance, a dissonance that arises from difference, the first thing is to face it, to bring it into view, to turn towards it instead of turning away. That's called friendliness. We have to be friendly with the difference instead of being antagonistic towards the difference. We have to realize that the signs of dissonance are noteworthy, that they're worthy of looking at and training ourselves to respond wholesomely. So let's say, what are some of these signs? So like, let's say if I'm about to write an angry letter to the yoga venue about the difference in pay, like you XYZs, you ABC'd and that DEF'd. And I think because of that, you're a GHI who's going to JK and L, and I'm going to MN and O and P U, et cetera. Okay, so that's called an unwholesome response. If I brought into view my discomfort or unease instead of getting counterphobic about it and, kind of going full-fledged into that adrenalinized response. So that would actually be noticing the sign in a wholesome way. If I could say, you know, I am uncomfortable with this. I've got so much discomfort and I don't really know what to say or what to do. So if I could acknowledge that feeling that I actually had before I send the letter, that's a wholesome response. While I was writing the letter, if I started A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, and P, and Q-ing, I could notice my unease or my sense of inauthenticity because it's not telling the whole message about me and my practice and how I want to relate to these people. And I can also notice the signs afterwards, like, am I rationalizing about what I did? Am I experiencing guilt or shame about what I did? Did my anger get worse instead of better by what I did? Okay, so I can face it. I can reduce the pain of it by practicing compassion. So I can actually feel my own pain. In a situation of dissonance, like coercion, or if I receive information that I didn't know about before, or some sort of change, or, a threat or whatever. If I can actually reduce my pain by acknowledging the emotion that I'm feeling and just naming or noting it. Because those emotions have been constructed for millions of years to give us necessary messages for our survival and growth. What are those messages? So, for instance, fear gives a message that we need support. Shame gives us a message that, or embarrassment or regret, gives us a message that we need to avow and renounce something for our own moral health, that we need accountability and reparation. When we feel, we need to be accountable. We need to repair something when we feel shame. When we feel grief, what do we need? What is that message? That's a message that we need some time, that we need some soothing or comforting, that we need some opening of the heart. When we feel pain, it's a message that we need to widen the window, that we need to practice resilience, that we need to communicate inside and out. Anyway, so we can face it, we can reduce the pain, we can increase our nourishment by noticing and celebrating any moments of non-pain that are occurring at the time. We can spread any joy or wholesomeness we can create, we can spread out into our lives and the lives of the other people who we're with. So I can give, actually, I think maybe I'll talk for about another 2 minutes. I'll give a physical example because this is not quite so theoretical, because I talked about the Abhidharma and I talked in a general kind of psychological way, but I just want to give you a real example of, let's give you a real example from my life of something I was really uncomfortable with. So one day I was going out to lunch and I found a parking space right in front of the restaurant, which never happens in that neighborhood. And so I was kind of smug about it and I was dancing over to the meter to put the quarter in. And as I put the quarter into the parking meter, a wall from a construction site fell on my head and back and broke my neck and gave me a multiple traumatic brain injury. So I lost all my languages, my executive function, and my ability to balance or to see. And I had brain damage. I had expressive aphasia, which was I was intensely embarrassed about. So my English became very slow. I had trouble finding words. By the time I was trying to answer somebody, they were long past the question. Anyway, and it was also, I also felt really ashamed because I was still in there, but I just couldn't find the words to respond until way after the situation. So there was always this feeling of not being met and horrible dissonance between my understanding of who I was and how I was able to function that I was incredibly ashamed about. So the first thing that I wanted to do was like deny it by pulling the covers over my head and never coming out of my room again. But instead, I faced it. And now I have impairments to my executive function and my ability to speak. So what am I going to do? So the first thing I did was to reduce pain. So by having compassion to myself. You know, okay, multiple traumatic brain injury does not reduce your value as a person. You're in there. It's not the you you think you are, but who is this you that's about to be born? You know, what's going to happen? So I started brain training. So I started training to distinguish difficult sounds like buh and duh, and practicing reading Dick and Jane. And I went to the library to work with Project Read, which is the literacy program of San Francisco Public Library. Karen, thank goodness for libraries. And anyway, I did a lot of other things. So basically, I had to pay attention to all the emotions. I had to learn how to name them and also how to make the facial expressions and respond to them, because I also lost my social abilities. And so I did that. That was a thing that I did. And along the way, I had various successes. And if I hadn't celebrated them, I would probably not be here today. And I could spread those benefits in my life as I learned something new. I could say, okay, I'm learning how to drive. Now that I have language, I'm reading the manual, and I want you to check my understanding by coming to, you know, coming into the car with me, and we're going to practice making left turns. Okay. And this is what AAA says, and let's test my comprehension. So we could take the stair step up to a social interaction that aimed at nourishing the successes that I had had. And as I did that, I was able to develop verbal skills to talk to physical therapists and professionals. And as I learned the words, my ability to think and create concepts and work with them began to grow, regrow. And so instead of never being able to talk again, I still don't have my languages all back, but I do have English and some of my languages. So that changed my thinking, not just about concepts, but about life. Okay, so that's an example from my personal life. So I'm going to shut up for a little while so you can comment and question and or, you know, express outrage or whatever. And thank you very much for your attention. And let's start the doors are open. The floor is yours. Let's speak.
Thank you, Vicki. We have one comment in the chat that your volume is low. I'm not experiencing that myself. It may be a function of, is anyone else experiencing a low difficulty of hearing? Now, it seems to be, so I have to say to the person who made that comment that I think it's idiosyncratic to your machine or device. Because I think everybody's indicating, including myself, that we can hear very well. So you'll have to look into that. If you'd like to make a question to Vicki, please raise your hand in the way in the Zoom, or I guess you can just wave out in the field there. We have a pretty small group, although I can't see everybody on this one screen. So it would probably be good if you raised your hand in the Zoom way.
Yeah, but first I'm going to respond to the person who couldn't hear me. Oh, good. I'm glad you couldn't hear that. We could talk about it. Write to me if you want to know about it. And either I'll tell you or I won't. Okay, anyone want to say or do anything? So I've got a whole other third of the lecture that I could give if you don't say anything, so be warned. Yeah, Homa, you want to unmute yourself?
Thank you very much, Vicki. I guess I was in my conceptual mind most of the time. The question that rose in my mind was, what would that mind and body be like when there's absolute no agenda, zero agenda of anything. Who would that be? What would that be? And then until then, you start to end it with the pain and the suffering that you actually went through. It took me out of that into the reality of what do I do with this pain now? What about this suffering? What about this pain? So from this whole view of no agenda, it turned to the absolute agenda, because now it's important for me to get myself back into being the way I was, at least close to what I was before.
Yeah, well, let's just say that they're not one and not two. So I want to give another example from that particular recovery.
Uh-huh.
So I was in the hospital, and I was in the intensive care. So I had to be taken to a level one trauma center because my life was at risk. And so the first night, I managed to somehow communicate for the nurses to arrange the pillows so I could sit zazen. So I've done a lot of pillow arranging in my life because I trained as an Iyengar yoga teacher, and then I started doing home chaplaincy for AIDS in the 1980s. And so I've done a lot of pillow arranging in my life. So I was able to somehow communicate to the nurses, I don't know how, that we needed the pillows to be arranged for zazen. So we did that. And then, you know, as soon as I started sitting, two of the nurses came in to sit with me. And then the next night, there were six nurses. And the nurses kept coming in to sit with me, and it was an absolute experience of joy. Absolute nourishment. And that hasn't gone away. The rest of the recovery and that are not two different things. They feel different. They're dissonant, but if you look at them a certain way, but if you look at them another way, they're not dissonant. You know, so I just had to be broken in a way that gave life.
Yeah, I appreciate your comment, but at this point, I don't have the experience. I cannot experience the, I don't know the word dissonant exactly, but I don't feel the oneness. I see it as broken. At this point, I see it as broken. I would love to see it as not broken. I would love to see it as a one steady movement or one steadiness. But at this point, there's still this, this thing in me is like,
What? Okay, good. Anyone besides me hearing dissonance, or am I the only one? Okay, so that dissonance, you feel so, you didn't just say, oh, thank you very much and go away. It motivated you to an act of speech. So that dissonance and that motivation exactly match in strength. That motivation is your power for wholesome investigation.
Mm.
The energy of that problem is the energy compelling you to solve it. But no thinking solution is going to help. So good luck with that. Okay.
I have several other questions. How about John Penfield and then Linda, followed by Jody?
I think you kind of answered my question. My first thought was like someone who experienced something like you did, how could one help them? And then I was going to ask you, well, what did you find helpful to you? And I think your example with the nurses sitting with you was certainly a beautiful answer. But if you have anything else, that'd be fine.
Oh, there's so many things. You know, it's like, it's nothing, it's not a special thing. Like, you know, John, if it were you and me, and I was your next door neighbor, you would do something and I would feel it. You know what I mean? It wouldn't be a special thing. It would be something that was just you. You know, you would be sitting there going, oh no, what do I do? Anything I can do is stupid in relation to what's really needed. Oh no, oh no, and oh. And then you'd have some idea. You'd say something like, oh, her teeth are broken. Let's make her a shake or whatever. Or, she can't really read. Maybe I'll read to her. Or maybe she's lonely. Or maybe she can't get up and do her laundry. She's got a broken neck. Or, you know, maybe she needs some hand cream to take away the friction that hard cast is giving. You know, whatever it was. I trust you to find the right thing if you're in.
Thank you. That's very helpful. It sounds more like just be there and be engaged and something will emerge.
Well, it's like you'll know if it's not the right thing. And that's how we grow in our hearts.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Linda?
So just because of John's question, I have to say, John and his wife, Valerie, for many times have known the right way to help me. So I don't think it's a major problem in that family.
A reality check. It's great how everyone knows each other, right? Not letting him get away with anything.
I was just gut punched this afternoon by something, and I'm still trying to process it. I live in a bubble. I live in this liberal progressive bubble, and I have a family back in Illinois that I very rarely see, and I knew that my brother was pretty conservative Christian, but there had never been any like real dissonance. Until I saw this afternoon on Facebook a thing he sent his daughter about the Black Lives Matter. And it was a video, and I thought, this is strange. So I started watching it, and it's horrible. It's really horrible from a fundamentalist Christian background of why, oh yeah, we don't want to be racist, but these Black Lives Matter people are really dangerous. And I am just, I'm having a really hard time. I'm still at the point of having the adrenaline rush.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you know you have to do something, right?
Yeah.
Because if you're silent or don't do something, you won't be able to, it's clear that you won't.
I can't live with myself if I don't do something.
I'm just going to ask, how important is it to you?
I'm really sad that this is coming from my brother, you know, although I don't know. I mean, maybe they just had a conversation where they were talking about how horrible this was. I don't know, you know, for sure. My feeling now is that I should really write to my niece who received this and say, I watched this video and I find it very disturbing. And here's a couple of highlights that I have an actual direct rebuttal to, because there's statements here that aren't true. But then I go, is that good?
May I make a request? My request is that you speak with your niece.
speak with my niece.
And my other request is that you get some Christian advice to do so. So that you find someone who deeply, deeply, deeply practices Christianity and would never post a video like that, and have some conversations with them to prepare yourself to speak with your niece. And that you could tell her right now, that invite her to have a conversation with you and tell her that you need to prepare for it. There's some books that I recommend, like Crucial Conversations and Crucial Confrontations, about how to speak in very stressful situations. Those are good books.
Okay.
And then also, I highly recommend, if you want a meditative approach to this, I highly recommend Rhonda McGee's book, The Inner Rhonda McGee, M-A-G-E-E, The Inner Work of Racial Justice. Okay?
Yeah. Thanks.
So find Christians to talk to who know the language.
Yeah.
Who you can prepare for a conversation with your niece that won't split your family up, but will say exactly what you need to say.
I know the church she's involved in Kansas City. I've seen pictures from events there, and it's a mixed, diverse congregation. So I'm hoping that she's as offended by this video as I am, but I don't know that.
Well, you could ask her, but... Yeah. But you need some support. I mean, just the sadness that you feel is a really good message that you need some time. You need some heart-opening work. And you need some nourishment. Yeah, that's what the emotion of sadness communicates, right? So it's a message. It's a message from something bigger than ourselves, bigger than the we who we think we are, about the work that we need to do. That's what those emotions are saying.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Jody? And then Oscar.
Russ has his hand up too.
You can go first.
So kind.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay. So thank you for your presentation. Something happened with my computer or whatever in the middle, and I got knocked out and then had to rejoin, so I missed some of it.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, me too, but that's okay. I can always, if it's recording, I can listen to the recorded version and pick it up. My question is sort of similar, I think, to Linda's. Just, I find, you know, certain, there's a whole bunch of things in the political world that I find extremely difficult. And so I've had kind of two ways of dealing with it, because I've become extremely angry, you know, to the point of like very, very bad thoughts. And I can rationalize them from here until kingdom come too. I'm not sure how to work with that. You know, one thing is, you know, I'm trying to find some way to get involved in something. So I, you know, am doing something. I don't just feel like I'm just sitting there powerless or whatever, that, you know, I'm involved in doing something. So I know that. But I'm not quite sure how to work with that. For example, on the pillow or on the cushion.
I give you some messages of anger, because Shanti Deva and those other people will just say, don't be angry. But I don't think that that's going to help you to practice patience. I think practicing forgiveness will help you, but to make the forgiveness meaningful, you need to assert. There needs to be a venue where you can assert. So anger, the messages of anger is threefold. As far as I can tell, needs, boundaries, respect. You know, so those are that, and you can use the anger of energy. So you might have missed the part of the lecture where I talked about what do you do when you find yourself rationalizing. That means that you have an event in the past, in the recent past, which was dissonant, and you're trying to get rid of the dissonance of the pain, usually by rationalizing the reaction that we had. And that's something that people do. And we don't have the luxury of doing right now because, you know, many of the issues that face us are so severe that our silence is violence in this situation. You know? So I'm sorry to use a slogan of silence equals violence, but I do feel this way. I'm not saying you have to hold any particular opinion. Please hold your opinion, but recognize that the message of anger has a deeper, wholesome reality to pay attention to, which is, what are your needs that aren't met? What are your boundaries that aren't honored? And what is the respect that's not given? And what are you going to do to assert the needs, to draw the boundaries and make them known, and to expect and ask for respect that hasn't been given firmly. So anyway, that's what you can do with anger. But you have to be able to practice forgiveness along with that, so that it's not the person but the action that you're addressing. So if we think that people are just bad people, we'll always reify self in relation to dissonance, and we'll always be the supposed good person who is reacting to the so-called bad person, and we'll become slaves of our anger. We can use that energy in wholesome ways if we master the process of assertion.
Thank you.
Sure.
Oscar?
Thank you. Thank you for that that host message. I was having trouble on the screen. Thank you, Victoria. I just am moved to say I really resonate with your topic tonight. I'm encountering a lot of dissonance, have been encountering sometimes a lot of dissonance with people that I'm interacting with on a regular basis, and I endorse your approach as far as I have been able to exercise to practice it, and particularly the acknowledgement of the frustration, anger, irritation, and so forth, and just being able to sit with that, and honor it and realize it's justified. And then, you know, remember my vows, and what I mean, that's sort of making it formal, but just remembering the way I really want to be in the world and how I want to be in the world.
Okay, let's just call up Homa's question again for a moment and just hold your question up in the light of Homa's question, where, you know, where is the unity in that dissonance? Where is the dissonance in that unity, right? How do they interrelate? How do we bear the feeling of dissonance? How do we create a safe container for practicing with it? what is the continuity and the stability that we need to uphold our basic attention when we feel that way? And actually, you know, when I started political activism, it was the 1960s, and I very quickly burned out because I didn't have that kind of safe container. I didn't have the understanding of nourishment and stability built up that would allow me to hold the feelings in a meditative way. So I burned out. And then in the 1970s, I came across what was to become the miracle of mindfulness, which was just a Xerox from Thich Nhat Hanh. It was a Xerox of a couple of sutras and practices that later turned into the book, The Miracle of Mindfulness. And it made all the difference. I didn't know that it was possible to practice with the feeling of anger instead of being pushed around by it, or the feeling of fear. I didn't know that. I mean, I intellectually knew it, but it made no difference in my actual actions. But when I started practicing freedom from anger without denying anger, then I learned how to hear the message, the necessary messages that anger was giving me. And I learned how to maintain a continuity of healing in body, speech, and mind that would safely hold that anger and direct its energy in wholesome ways. So that's what I want to give you. I want to put it in a little package and wrap it nicely and put a bow on it and just hand it to you.
Thank you.
Sure. Anytime. Are we okay on time, Jim? Are we?
Yeah, I think we should have one more question. Russ, I think, wanted to say a question, and then maybe we should put a ribbon around it.
Okay, yeah, thank you. I was struck by your story about the fiery letters of oppression being spelled out in front of you, and you kept pushing it away. And was there more to the message that was being, you know, the message being sent to you other than not oppressing yourself? Is there more to the story there?
Oh my gosh.
That you're willing to share, obviously.
Yeah. What I realized was that, you know, Holocaust survivors, that my entire life had been shaped by this, that I had epigenetic trauma that had been carried down through many, many generations, and I had become it. And that unless I actually studied and took care of it, that I would be a bitter, kind of hypocritical person, because the world would never see how truly wounded and angry and so on. And I had just turned all of that inwards. And it was really deforming my ability to be in the world and to be intimate with people. It was making me not a trusting person. You know, so I realized that I had a lot of work to do. So I started doing it. And so the first thing that I did was as soon as I gave voice to even a tiny little bit of it, I was consumed with rage. Mm. That rage lasted for 2 years. And I was scared to speak because I was scared of what would come out. And so I got a pebble and I sanitized it and put it in my mouth and kept it there for 6 weeks so that every time I spoke, I would have to speak around the pebble. So it would give me just a moment of choice so that instead of being pushed around by one side of the dissonance, that I could remember my intention and then speak from there. And I wasn't good at it. But I practiced it again and again. And so I thought, okay, if I make every mistake once, then sooner or later, I've got to be able to grow. I'm not equipped to be a person in this world. I have to equip myself. And this speech, right? Speech is one of the ways I have to do it. So I started practicing it then. And then shortly after that, I was ordained. Oh, and then the rage came back. I realized that the meditation instructions that I had been taught were basically designed for 18-year-old Japanese boys. So then I got enraged all over again that there aren't any instructions for menopause. There aren't any instructions for pregnancy. There aren't any instructions for old men. There aren't any instructions for little boys. You know, what's going on here? No instructions for the variety of people there are in this world. This is an oppressive regime of Zazen. You know, so then I thought, okay, I'm going to do something about this. I'm going to quit Tassajara. I'm going to go get trained as a yoga teacher, and I'm going to create universally designed Zazen practice. But that is another story for another time. So there we go.
Thank you. Okay.